Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. The difficulties and the rewards of being a humanitarian aid worker in Indonesia during the December 2004 tsunami and the massive earthquake that followed. The finale of Beethoven's Fidelio celebrates the history of the Church and salvation. The last time I saw my friend Jude Barrand, she was about to set off for Afghanistan in the aftermath of the war there, as part of an international aid workers team. She spent over 2 years in and around Kabul, helping to implement health and education projects far from home and from her family. I was looking forward to her return to Europe when she was whisked off to Indonesia as Director of Communications for a medical NGO called SurfAid International. Jude's dedication to her job as a humanitarian aid worker is total. And we, her friends and family, know that a new crisis or a sudden emergency may thwart her plans for a visit home at any moment. Finally, the last project she was involved in came to an end, and Jude actually managed to spend a week in Rome catching up with old friends. Amongst the many things we spoke about, I asked her about her recent experiences abroad. I was so moved by what she told me, I've decided to share them with you.
I arrived in Indonesia in June 2004, which was 6 months before the tsunami. The project that I was involved in was a malaria control project because Indonesia has a huge amount of malaria. In certain areas, it's endemic. And in the area in which we were particularly focused, that's to say Sumatra and the western islands to the west of Sumatra, they're called the Mentawai Islands, malaria is it's hyper-endemic, which means that it's there all the time. And in the worst affected areas, one out of every two children will die before the age of five from malaria or a malaria-related disease because they're so weakened by the fever, these cycles of fever that go on throughout their infancy, that they're carried off by something as banal as a simple flu or malnutrition breaks them down, and then they get the malaria again, another cycle, and that eventually kills them. It's absolutely devastating to see in this day and age in areas that are remote but not inaccessible, children dying at these rates from diseases that are entirely preventable. And that's what we went out to do. We also did an immunization program targeting mothers and children with an emphasis on things like measles, polio, which again, believe it or not, are still killing thousands of children in this particular area every year. Measles is something that we have almost forgotten about in the West because it's so controlled. Children are immunized as a matter of course, but there it's deadly. And it's also extremely contagious. So if it hits a community, it can wipe out the entire child population virtually overnight. So these are very trying, difficult, challenging health issues that we went out to address.
Now, when we say Indonesia, I mean Indonesia is a really large nation.
Indonesia is a very interesting country. It's extremely diverse culturally. It's extraordinarily large. The archipelago stretches across virtually the whole of Southeast Asia. It goes from the Malaysian Peninsula, Singapore, all the way down almost to Australia. So that's a huge amount of territory that it covers. It reaches across islands as varied geographically as Kalimantan, Sulawesi, Sumatra in the north, Java, and then you've got places like Timor and Bali. Every single one of these islands is extremely different, the one from the other. In places like Java, you do have pockets of poverty, but on the whole, Java is a very wealthy island. The further away, and Java is where the capital Jakarta is, so it's a seat of power, you have infrastructure, you have resources. The further away you get from the centre, the administrative centre of this archipelago, the harder and the more obvious the poverty is. And by the time you get to the outer islands of West Sumatra, or a place called Nusa Tenggara, where there are huge problems with water, access, communications, you get outbreaks of malnutrition, you have malaria, you have all these issues. And unfortunately, because they are far-flung, because it is difficult to reach these places, there's not a lot that's being done in real concrete terms. On a national level, these places unfortunately aren't getting the attention they need.
And on an international level, are there other aid agencies out there?
Aid agencies working in Indonesia are extremely aware of these pockets of extreme poverty, extreme need. It ranges across the entire spectrum of social need, from housing to education to health. And there is a lot of excellent work that is being done on the ground, but the population of Indonesia is very large. It's the largest Islamic nation in terms of population in the world, 220 million people. They also have a growing population, although figures have come down from 6 children per mother in the 1960s on average, down now in the year 2000, in the 2000s, to around 2.6 children per woman. That's still an increment, and the Indonesian government's working very hard to bring the population down to a level where it's ticking over. The numbers that are being born are replacing those who are dying. That level is called replacement level. They expect to reach replacement level within the next 15 years, but until then the population will continue to grow.
You were also in Indonesia when the tsunami struck, and I imagine that changed the urgency of your work.
Well, actually, I was in England because I'd returned for Christmas. So I arrived back in the UK, which is where I'm from, on the 23rd of December. On the 26th of December, the news reached us that this tsunami had happened. And, of course, where we are based, in West Sumatra, we not only felt the effects of the earthquake that triggered the tsunami, but we were within immediate reach of people who'd been affected. Where we actually were based, which is a place called Padang on the west coast of Sumatra, miraculously, Padang escaped the tsunami. But the islands where we'd been working were hit very hard, some of them. We immediately deployed medical teams because that's what we were. We are an NGO that was set up by two volunteer doctors and a couple of other volunteers who had gone out to these islands really on holiday, witnessed the amount of deprivation, been absolutely shocked and horrified that nothing that they could see was being done that was having any kind of effect, had come back, lobbied the government, the local government, the local NGOs to try to do more out there. And when they realised that no one had the capacity to do that, they decided to do the work on their own. So that was the beginnings of Surf Aid. With that mandate and that medical background and that kind of expertise, Surf Aid had already been working in the islands by now since 2000. So there were relationships, there were networks, there was trust, there was understanding that had already been built up. And not only that, Surf Aid was on the ground already with medical equipment in place. So whilst everybody else was flying vital emergency equipment to the scene of the disaster, Surf Aid was already in the thick of it with people on the ground, with medical crews, with vital emergency equipment, the medicines, the surgical kits that were needed. And I returned immediately to Indonesia. We immediately started deploying those kits, those teams, and we went up to the worst affected areas within our immediate scope of reach. And the islands that we visited included Nias, which was subsequently hit by a devastating earthquake which did even more damage. Perhaps we'll touch on that later. And what we found was just some of the worst scenes I have ever seen. We also went up to Simalu, which is another island off the west coast of Sumatra, and that's in Aceh. And there again, whole communities have been destroyed, but miraculously, because these islands are prone to tsunamis, or they have been in the past, hundreds of years ago, in the case of Simalu, more than 100 years ago, people remembered there was an oral legend about the symptoms of the sea retreating and then coming back as a massive devouring wave. And the people had all retreated to the hills, and they were incredibly, only 7 lives were lost on that island.
But you say you saw some of the worst scenes you've ever witnessed, and we've seen photographs and footage, but nothing in compared to what being there and feeling the people. Do you like to tell me about that?
It was one of the most heartbreaking things you can imagine. On top of the fact that the horror was so very tangible, there were bodies in the sea. There were people who were inconsolable. Their grief was just so overwhelming. But I think the very worst thing, I mentioned Simalu, only 7 people died in the tsunami. It was a miracle. They all retreated up into the hills, and they only came back down when they were confident that they were safe. Their villages were completely destroyed. However, as the days went by, it became obvious that there was a bigger tragedy just around the corner, because Simalu, being a very small island with very few possibilities in terms of education and work, what families on that island do is they send their children to boarding school in Aceh. Their husbands go to Aceh to find work. The women remain. And as the days went by and the news came out of Aceh, they realised that they'd lost all their families. They'd lost their children, they'd lost their husbands. And by this stage, days had gone by, and the grief grew every day. So it was terribly hard to be next to these people in these shattered communities. Their lives were destroyed. Women who had 6 children the day before woke up and realised, with the days that elapsed, that they'd lost all their children, and as often as not, their husbands as well. And within days, the island was just a terrible scene of grief. And there was nothing we could do. We were a medical team. We could go in and fix those people who had been injured. We could help those. We could medevac the people who'd been injured. But the people who'd lost family on another part of the island, on another part, on the other end of Sumatra, we could do nothing for. We stayed with them for as long as we could. And we offered as much support as we could, and we directed the other NGOs who were able to offer counselling services. But I will never forget the women in those communities. I will never forget them.
Moving on, how is reconstruction going in the hardest hit areas there?
The analogy I always think of, because we battled and struggled, these islands are so remote. It would take us 36 hours by boat to get up to Nias from Padang, and we were the closest NGO on the ground with boats that are available to our teams. The other NGOs arrived, they didn't have boats, they didn't have infrastructure, they didn't know the area. We knew the area very well, and we struggled. And despite that, we were recognised by the UN as being at the forefront of this mission, as being key informers to the entire NGO community. We were able to tell them where the reefs were, we knew where the communities were, we knew the villages. We really did have a huge amount of knowledge that we gave openly and shared, and the UN depended on us at certain points for key advice and information. Despite the fact that everybody was pulling with all their might, there were huge difficulties overcoming the fact that the entire infrastructure of Aceh in particular, and of the islands where we were working, had been wiped out, absolutely destroyed. Even if you arrived with an airplane, a Hercules, full of food, how were you going to distribute it? And the chances are you couldn't even land on the runway, because the runway had been damaged as well. So there were huge problems of access. And we struggled with this very hard. And then we were in the middle of still trying to address all this when there was that terrible Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. And we just realised that here was New Orleans, a city in the world's most developed country, which had collapsed as a result of a devastating natural disaster, in a similar way to the situation we found ourselves in, except we were in a country with no backup, no resources, no infrastructure even outside of the affected area, and none of the expertise in terms of personnel and capacity. And moreover, we weren't talking about a few thousand dead, and that was a tragedy for everybody in New Orleans. We were talking about tens of thousands of people dead, hundreds of thousands of people displaced over an area that was just incomprehensibly large. Really, it was a vast area in Indonesia alone. And of course, the Indian Ocean tsunami and earthquake affected countries as far away as the Seychelles on the other side of the Indian Ocean. So we were really up against it to meet the challenge. However, I do believe that the effort and the work and the dedication that went into that effort was extraordinary. And although things now perhaps aren't discussed as much in the media, they are going on with as much energy and as much vigour as they were before. And it's always hard, I think, when you know that you have hundreds of thousands of people who are refugees, to watch them day in, day out, go back home to a tent, when you want to put them in a home. But as I mentioned, we were hit by a second earthquake. And so much of the work that had been done in those first 3 months after the tsunami on Nias were completely destroyed all over again. And I think that was one of the bleakest moments that we as humanitarian workers in the region faced. We'd spent 3 months telling everybody, come home, we're going to make sure that you have what you need to get on with your lives. They came home and we'd given out all the materials that we could give to help rebuild, and we weren't the only ones doing that. Other NGOs were building shelters, and we were hit by a huge earthquake on the 30th of March, and it just, everything was, it wasn't even back to square one, it was back to minus 10. And that was a huge blow to the people of Nias and to everybody who's working flat out. And what it did is it actually made everybody stop and just say, are we doing what needs to be done? This is an area that has terrible tectonic activity. It has regular tectonic activity and it can be terrible. As a matter of fact, the aftershocks are still ongoing. The aftershocks were very strong in the immediate aftermath of the tsunami and the earthquake. And it was a very frightening time for everybody. And I think it's just reminded people that we need to be very humble. We live on this earth by geological consent, subject to change without notice. We can't control that, and we need to be sensitive to that. And we need to work with that. And that's very much the approach that we've been taking, that the UN is taking, that all the other NGOs are taking. So it looks perhaps like a very slow approach, but what it is that it's a way of handling a very precarious situation so that the work that's done now isn't ripped down by the next earthquake.
You're a humanitarian worker and you go out into very desperate situations and witness such a lot of pain. Why? What makes you do it?
I have always wanted to write, and I have always wanted to be a witness to the things that I believe to be important, because it's so easy for us to close ourselves off in our world. And I believe that when we close ourselves off in our worlds, and we are fortunate, our world is privileged, we create an injustice that triggers a situation of anger and rancor and frustration, which means that we threaten our worlds, because by this short-sighted closure or introspection, we don't see the suffering of others. And when we don't see the suffering of others, we risk alienating them. And one day their anger boils up, comes to the front, and then we live in a world of conflict. And I really believe that if we are to live in the kind of world that our children deserve, all of us, we need to be aware of each other's suffering, and we need to share it, and we need to reach out to each other and be there, help each other, understand each other, support each other. And that is why I chose to do this, and it's hard sometimes, but it's also extraordinarily rewarding, and I've been very lucky. I think the thing that I take away from all of this is that I have lived some extraordinarily beautiful moments with people who have shown me what it is to be a human being, to have the dignity and the strength, because life isn't easy, and we all have moments where we need to excavate and find something inside to meet challenges and rise above them. And these people, these experiences, just show you how much we all have to learn, and how by sharing those things we enrich ourselves and those around us. It's so true, it's banal almost. So I just feel lucky, really blessed.
That was Jude Barrand talking about her experiences as Director of Communications for Surf Aid International. And now we join Father Jim Brand, Spiritual Director of the Beda College in Rome, who uses music to reflect on deep spiritual insights. Today he accompanies us through the final chorus of Beethoven's opera Fidelio, in which he points out, "Music rings out, celebrating the history of the Church, and sings to us of salvation."
In my last talk, the second, about the opera Fidelio, we left Florestan at the beginning of Act Two, having mourned his death before he died. He did an act of resignation to his fate, he did a review of life, and the angel comforter came to him, just like our Lord in his last 24 hours. By the way, we have to remember our Lord was in death row overnight. Found guilty officially and had to mourn his death before he died. Well, his wife Leonora dresses the boy Fidelio, and the jailer appear in the background to dig a grave, and then the wicked governor comes to assassinate Florestan, but his wife Leonora, dressed as Fidelio, intervenes, and there's this wonderful trumpet call on the tower because the local prince has come to investigate prisoner abuse. So, because of her fidelity to her husband, she entered the prison to save him, because she couldn't save him from outside, and through her generosity he is saved, and with him and by him and for him all the rest of the prisoners are saved, and they're all out on the square, and the local prince sees to sort of some just trial of the wicked governor. And the last chorus is really rather like the sort of things we might be singing in heaven when we've all been saved through the love and generosity of Jesus, who came into our prison to lead us all out from solitary confinement. And this is what they're going to sing. Well, first of all, the opening reminds of the history of the Church. The music will start with what I would imagine original little Jewish instruments, and then you'll hear the Greeks coming in, and then Europe. It's all building up the orchestra of the Church. Then India, North Africa. You'll hear the 76 trombones from across the Atlantic coming in. Finally, the drums of Africa, building up this wonderful cultural heritage of our Church. And what they're going to sing are these words. Heil die Tage, heil die Stunde. Hail the day, hail the hour. Long hoped for, but unforeseen. Justice and mercy have appeared at the threshold of the grave. in the second verse, you'll hear some women singing. Now, in music, somebody who's not musical will tend to hit the first and third beats of a bar. Bar, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. Sounds like sort of heavy lumps of steamed puddings. But the first and third beats of the bar, because they are the first and third beats, are already emphasised. So somebody who's musical, like Beethoven, will sometimes emphasise the second and the fourth. So instead of it's one, two, three, four, it's one, two, three, four, one, two. Keeps it moving. So the ladies start singing on offbeat. The men think it's such a good idea, they imitate them. So in music, it's sometimes a wonderful thing to be a little offbeat. Spiritual people, please note. So this final chorus reminds me of the sort of things we might be singing in heaven. A bit like some of the things in the book of Revelation. And we're all reunited. Now, I don't know what time is outside this world, but I myself feel that heaven doesn't really start until we've all got there. I don't know how I could feed my face in heaven if I'm allowed to get there whilst people are still suffering on earth. I think they're spending their time polishing the silver for when everyone is there. After all, if there was a state banquet, and as soon as I reached my place, I sat down and dived into the first course, they think that's very rude. We wait until the VIPs have arrived, until everyone is there. Then we all say grace and we all start together. And for me, the last day is when the party will really begin. When the last people have arrived, and until then, people in heaven are getting the party ready. And I hope that I'd rather be there when they're on the cheese and biscuits with my friends than to get there first for the soup. Especially with all people who've suffered various forms of imprisonments and who felt that they were solitary in their confinement, and they were finally found and brought in, like the lost sheep out in the desert alone. The Good Shepherd finds that solitary lost sheep and brings him back with a big cuddle to join the rest of us, who are all prisoners of one sort or another, but at least we know we're not solitary. Amen. Gefesselt leuchtet ihr vor mir.
That's all from the English feature program today, but we will be back at the same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at 105live.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus. Kein Wort, sie kam dort an mein Tor und trat als Knecht in meine Dienste und tat so brave, treue Dienste, dass ich zum Eingang sie erkor. Stunde vollziehen an Flores Hallenmord. Mit ihm!